This is The Book Show. You can follow us on Twitter at BookshowRTE and listen to our past shows on SoundCloud and the RTE player. Tonight, we'll talk to Maggie O'Farrell about her latest novel, This Must Be the Place. But first, Sarah Taylor's first book, The Shore, was a collection of interlinked stories and was nominated for the Bailey's Prize. Her latest book is The Lauras, and it follows a mother and child on a road trip and touches on themes of identity and place. But we're first introduced to them in the middle of a frantic row, as Sarah Taylor explains.
When we meet them at the beginning, the mother is having a fight with her partner. It's the middle of the night, and these fights happen pretty much nightly, and their child, 13-year-old named Alex, is listening. And this night is different because this night the fighting stops, and the mother comes and picks Alex up, and they get in the car and they start driving. And Alex doesn't really know what's going on or where things are going, and doesn't really know the mother's history or background or why she might want to leave or where she might want to go if she'd left. And that slowly gets pieced in the farther they get from home.
It's a very sort of peripatetic trip, and it sounds very unplanned and random because they run off in the middle of the night. But Ma's very specific about where she wants to go and even has a detailed map full of stars and notes. So what is her plan and why?
At the beginning, she doesn't really have a plan. And I've often wondered myself what would happen if I did just drop my life and go off unplanned and explore the world. And I think many people wonder that. But as the farther she does get away from her adult home, the more her plan comes together, because she's has places across the United States that she's meant to return to that were important to her as a young person. So when she finally makes the emotional break with the home that she's made with the partner she leaves, she decides to go back to those places, and that's when her map comes into play, as she and Alex are waiting to gather together enough money and come up with a plan. She decides that she's going to make a list of all of the places she meant to return to. And when she does that, she decides which of them are important enough to actually go back to, and then starts checking them off as they travel.
When they head off and they get into the car and they're on the road, it sort of sets up what's going to happen in some way when they're traveling together. So let's hear a section from the book.
My mother had never been much of a storyteller. I knew the vagaries of her life, the foster homes, and that she had a green card, the fact that she hadn't spoken to her parents since she was a teenager. But it wasn't until we left home that she began writing in the details. Maybe she began telling me then because she felt guilt, or whatever her version of guilt was, over leaving and taking me with her and not explaining anything. Maybe the stories had finally backed up in her and she had to let them out. Around sundown on the day that she threw her phone out the window, we pulled off the highway into one of those graveled roads that crossed the tree-covered median where cops sometimes sit to watch for speeding drivers. And that's when she started telling me about her childhood.
And that was Sarah Taylor there reading from The Lauras. Sarah, Ma is never named, and her and Alex end up on the move, and it's partly a road trip, but it's not just about escape, is it? There's also a sense that maybe Ma is trying to make sense of her own past.
I think that is a big part of it. And also the fact that the mother is never named, which actually makes it more difficult to talk about the book now, is reflective of the fact that Alex can never get past thinking of her just as mother, even though they're moving through the landscape of her past and seeing firsthand that she has a history. She is a person in her own right, separate from her mother role. Alex can't stop thinking of her as Ma, and I think a lot of the story is about that parent-child relationship and how children at some point need to start realizing, or do start realizing, that their parents are real people. And also on the flip side, Ma starts realizing that Alex is a person separate from herself the farther they get from their starting point.
Let's talk about Alex. Do you have a preferred pronoun for Alex? Because this is a character who doesn't identify as either gender. And I'm wondering, how does he or she come to terms with the world, both as a teenager and as somebody who is non-binary?
My preferred pronoun for Alex has been they, but I've always thought that English needs to expand to include a singular gender-neutral pronoun. And the fact that it doesn't have one right now, and people argue about that, just makes life more difficult. And I think the entire novel is about Alex trying to come to terms with what not identifying fully with either gender means to them, and trying to get the world to come to terms with that as well. And it's less important at the beginning of the novel, to the point that a lot of people I know who've read it didn't realize that Alex didn't have a gender until halfway through, because at the beginning, Alex is still identifying as a child, and no one cares what gender children are, they're gender child. But as Alex starts reaching adolescence and has to start thinking about becoming an adult, coming to terms with gender identity and all of the baggage of adulthood becomes more and more important, not necessarily to Alex, but to everyone that's around Alex. And so I think near the end of the book, that issue comes to a head and is not dealt with directly, but Alex is forced to at least confront it directly.
In making the character of Alex non-binary, or somebody who doesn't identify with either gender, did you have any concerns about getting it right?
Not really. I think I come from an unusual point of view in that I sat down recently and went through the list of people that I spend time with regularly. I think a third of them are either non-binary or don't identify with a traditional gender or in a traditional way. So it's a viewpoint that I've been around a lot, to the point that for me it's just one of the normal options. And when I was a child, I thought of myself and everyone in my age group as a blank that was going to grow up to be either like their mother or their father as they personally chose. And I was kind of baffled when I got to adolescence and realized, oh, wait, I don't get to choose. So I was less concerned with getting it right in a sort of overarching archetypal way as representing my experience and the experience of people who I cared about and have spent time with that doesn't really get represented very often in fiction.
The title of the book hints at a narrative device that you use to tell the story. So who are the Lauras?
The Lauras are a succession of women that have been important in Ma's life, either because they have influenced her personal life path or because they're people she has loved either as friends or romantic partners, or people that have left her behind, or people that she has left behind. And throughout her life, she has continuously run into women named Laura who have been important. And at one point in the book, she explains why she thinks this is. It's, yes, there are many women in her age group who are named Laura, but also the first best friend she ever made was Laura. And so she was continuously on the lookout for someone to fill that best friend hole that the first Laura left. I think it happens to many people that someone is so significant to them that they forever after treat the other people with the same name that they meet slightly differently. And actually, I know a lot of people that refuse to ever date anyone with the same name as their father or an ex-boyfriend.
Probably a good plan. I mentioned your debut, The Shore, which was longlisted for the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction, and it's set on a collection of islands off the coast of Virginia. The Lauras is also very concerned with place because you visit so many states and small towns. So why is landscape so important to your work?
I don't know if I know that answer yet, but I'm certainly preoccupied by landscape. In The Shore, I was trying to get a portrait of a place to take with me when I left. And that was written while I was in Virginia on the shore. The Lauras was written while I was in Norfolk in the United Kingdom, missing parts of my childhood in America, specifically the long road trips my family would go on. So I think in both cases that my obsession with place comes to the background, if not the forefront, because the books are in a way a vehicle of remembering and preserving a place that I feel is transient and is going to pass away. And will I continue to do that? I don't know.
And The Lauras is published by William Heinemann. Now, many of us will understand the pressure our book collection puts on our living space. There are piles everywhere and shelving isn't cheap. Some of us may indulge in the occasional book cull, but it's not that easy, as Regan Hutchins is finding out.
I do not need two Edith Sitwell biographies. My bookshelves are heaving. It's time for a cull, and this time I'm going to be brutal.
And this is a memoir by her secretary. Yeah, it was a bit pricey and might be good for research. So why do we cull books? We cull books when we become minimalists or dictators, or when we move in with a loved one, or when we need to make room for new books, or just when we get a fit. No more clutter, no more dust, no more unread volumes glaring at us. Gone. So here's my guide to a good book cull.
That can go.
Be honest with yourself.
No, I've always hated those poems.
Be objective.
A book on freaky clowns? I think that ship has sailed.
Be critical.
No, these memoirs were discredited. Turns out she was lying.
And soon, the results will show. Look, I've already cleared enough space for the complete works of Sir Walter Scott. The most important rule is never regret it.
Hey, regret?
What if I throw out the wrong Edith Sitwell biography? You see, this one has a really detailed index. And this one has beautiful coloured plates. What if I decide to do a PhD on Edith Sitwell's poetry and then I'll regret not having two biographies?
Yeah, well, I mean, I just won't be able to do the PhD then.
What if I regret this bibliocide? In a horrifying essay written in 2014 called I Murdered My Library, novelist Linda Grant describes throwing out her books. Piles of them. Rows of them. Entire bookcases. Even André Gide was tossed aside, and if that isn't bad enough, what's truly horrifying is that she admits at the end of it that she bitterly regrets it. The sight of the bare shelves shames her. What have I done? She gasps. Books do furnish a room, and in my case, they also take up most of it, most of the house, in fact. They're dusty, they've faded in the sunlight, they're very heavy, and often extremely ugly. Books are old friends, on the other hand. We reach out for our favourites in times of need. We cradle them the way we might a tiny baby. Their smell comforts us. We're just used to having them around like an old pet, and the very thought of banishing one from the house, well, I'd rather put a dog in the rain. So, naturally, I'm thinking of Linda Grant's essay today. Ooh, I didn't know I have this one. Oh, look what I wrote in here. Oh, already beginning to regret. Oh, there it is. I thought I had lost this one. Probably making a mistake. No, not that. It's signed. I know I don't like him, but he might become famous one day. Can't quite remember if I read this. Let me have a look. Maybe now's not the time.
Thanks to Regan Hutchins for that. Well, if you'd like to read Linda Grant's essay, I Murdered My Library, it's available, appropriately enough, as a Kindle single. Maggie O'Farrell's seventh novel, This Must Be the Place, is the story of an ex-movie star, Claudette Wells, and her marriage to the American academic Daniel Sullivan. She's now a recluse and living in Ireland, protected by the close rural community who surround her. I met Maggie O'Farrell recently and began by asking her where she got the inspiration for the character of the movie star, Claudette Wells.
Almost several years ago, I was in Soho in London, and I went into a cafe just for a cup of tea, and there was a really strange atmosphere in the room, and I couldn't work out why. And then I realised sitting opposite me was an incredibly famous film actress. I mean, so famous she'd have been known anywhere instantly in the world. You know, it was a really strange experience seeing her, because I think your first reaction when you see someone that famous is to think, oh, I know you. You know, do I know you from the school run or yoga class? But of course, you know, you don't. Then your second thing is, oh, God, actually, I don't know you. You're just very famous. And at some point, I actually ended up walking to the ladies' loo behind her. I was a couple of steps behind her, and it was only walking in her slipstream that you get a kind of sense or a whiff of what it must be like to be that famous, and actually how horrific it is, because there were banks of paparazzi outside the cafe and everybody was, you know, taking photos and turning around to look at her. And I got to the ladies, she was already in there, and she just had her forehead leaning against the mirror, and she looked like she was on the verge of tears. And the terrible thing is, you know, if she'd been anybody else, I would have said to her, you know, is there something I can do to help you? You know, what can I do? But being who she was, you can't. There's a kind of force field around her. So as I was leaving the cafe, I had to kind of push my way out through the photographers, and I just thought, God, if I was her, I would fake my own death and I'd run away. I couldn't live like that. I couldn't live that existence. And then I took a few more steps across the road and I thought, that's a good idea for a novel.
Well, let's get a sense of what this character's life is like in the book. It's sort of not the same situation, but equally quite claustrophobic with the reading.
Look up, please, the makeup girl says. With a gunfire of static, the robe is unvelcroed from her. The two attendants take a step back in unison, their heads on one side. One darts forward with a comb to tease a strand of hair into place. The other screws up her face in what seems to be a dissatisfied grimace. I'm not sure about the... the other agrees. They stare at her, then they shrug. The taller one looks, if not quite at her, then near her. You're done, Miss Wells, she says, with a smile that reveals pink, healthy gums. Thank you, Claudette says. Thank you. Waiting for her at the trailer door is a person with a clipboard and headset. He doesn't greet her, but speaks about her into his microphone. Miss Wells is leaving makeup, he narrates, stepping in beside her. We're heading towards the set right now. ETA 2 minutes. Oh, she stopped to pick up something. No, we're on our way again. Yes, hair and makeup finished. Yes. She walks through groups of people. They part as she approaches, like iron filings repelled by a magnet. They look at her, then away, quickly, too quickly, as if she might be enraged by their gaze, as if looking upon her might turn them to stone.
And that was Maggie O'Farrell reading there from This Must Be the Place. So we hear from lots of different characters, not just Claudette and Daniel. There's lots of men and women and children. So what prompted you to explore this narrative through various voices and genders and ages?
Well, I think my instinct with this book was to write something that really ripped up all the rules. I just had this urge to test the boundaries of what the novel could do as a medium. I wanted to see what it was capable of, and I wanted to find different ways to tell a story, to break down narrative into lots of different angles, lots of oblique angles. You know, I think we're, as human beings, we're very complex, nuanced characters. You know, I don't think we are neat and chronological, and no story, to me, can be told from one point of view. You know, there's always hundreds of different jostling viewpoints that can be taken into account. So with this book, I suppose I just wanted to embrace the kind of chaos that I feel that's inside us all.
The story isn't told chronologically, which is really interesting. It works and it spans almost 40 years. Was that something that you planned to do, or did that just shape present itself to you?
Well, I think a lot of books are a reaction to their predecessors in a way. And the book I wrote previously was Instructions for a Heatwave, and that it has quite very strict technical boundaries. You know, it takes place over 4 days and it's got 4 voices and it's got 2 locations. It's London and it's the west of Ireland. And so after I finished that book, I just felt like, I mean, I've never worn a corset, I should say, but it felt a bit like ripping one off. And I thought, actually, now I can do anything. Now I can take it anywhere. I can write as long a book as I want. I can write as many layered characters, as many viewpoints. So I just had the urge to just write something big, I suppose, geographically and also in terms of number of pages.
So we've heard about Claudette, and she's a very visible public person, but Daniel is an academic. It's a different kind of life. So who is he?
Well, Daniel is an Irish-American, and he is from New York, and he kind of washes up slightly accidentally in Donegal. He's tracking down the ashes of his grandfather. And so he's there sort of slightly by accident, and he comes across a woman at the side of the road whose car has broken down, and he stops to help her. And he doesn't realise why she's quite so unfriendly and a little bit aggressive. And the penny doesn't drop for him that she's actually a very, very famous actress who's become a recluse. And it's only later in the day. Because it's funny, I was actually, you know, while I was trying to decide where it was that Claudette should live, I was in Donegal and I thought, you know what, it should be here. This is where she could disappear, I think, because it's so, you know, there are places and it's so remote. But also there's something about, I think, the sort of Irish character that I think that there's, I think they look after their own, you know, and I think they would actually. There's not many places in the world where people would protect her and they wouldn't let people know who she was and where she was. But I thought, actually, the people of Donegal, I think they would. I think they would keep her secret for her.
So as well as drawing on real life for the character of Claudette, you've written about your daughter's eczema and the fact that it's one of the characters in the book, Niall, he's Daniel's older son, and he suffers very badly with a kind of a condition. Obviously, this is quite close to you, and to write a sympathetic portrayal of it is, you know, is it easy for you to do, or is it something, did you not want to include something like this because you're close to it, or is it a case of, you know, I wanted to see an accurate representation of it because it often isn't written about, or it's miswritten about?
I think my urge with Niall to write about his eczema like that is that I think came from the fact that everybody in the book is uncomfortable in their skin at one point or another. And Niall, with his very severe eczema, is a sort of literal representation of that idea. So his skin is literally unlivable. But it does come from life. You know, it's not often I write autobiographically, but my middle child was born with really chronic eczema. So it was, and still continues to be, a huge part of our lives, you know, trying to take care of her and make her comfortable, or as comfortable as she can be. But I think also I had the urge really to write about, I wanted to write a fully realised character who has this condition, because so often in fiction, if you read a character with eczema or allergies or asthma or something like that, they're often treated as a kind of joke, actually. People sort of, it's used as a kind of byword for a sort of someone who's a weakling or a bit pathetic or a bit wimpy. And that makes me so cross, actually, because, you know, the kids, particularly kids who have these things, you know, they're the opposite of that. They're the essence of stoicism and toughness. And it's funny, my daughter was reading a very popular series of kids' books recently, and there's a character in that, the kind of hero sidekick who's got eczema. And she said to me, "Why is it funny?" And I said, "Well, it's not, is it? It's not funny."
It's also, it was striking me about, I know you've spoken before about having like a stammerous daughter.
In the book, there needs to be a reason why Ari, who is Claudette's son from her previous relationship, Ari and Daniel strike up this bond almost immediately. And I think there needed to be something that Daniel could help him with. And Ari has a really bad stammer, and Daniel in his past, because he's a linguist, has worked with kids with stammer. So he's able to help him straight away. And Ari latches onto him. And it's kind of through Ari that Daniel and Claudette actually get together. He's slightly, even though he's a very little boy, he slightly manipulates their second meeting.
You write about home and families and relationships, and then you're a female writer. It often gets called domestic, and when men do it, it's the human condition. And yet family is such a central theme in lots of literature. So why is it a theme that you go back to?
Well, I think families are always going to be a fascination for writers. You know, I mean, we all have one, don't we? Whether we are in touch with, you know, we all come from at least two people. And I think also, I think families are a sort of fascinating crucible in a way of lots of different personalities all in one space. You know, there's a kind of mathematical formula you can follow. So if you have, say, five people in a family, there are 25 different relationships. You know, Freud said that every sibling has a different mother. And that sentence in itself is an interesting one to unpack. So I think you're always going to be interested. I mean, you know, you look at something like Hamlet, which is my favourite Shakespearean play. I mean, that's a fantastic domestic drama, isn't it? I mean, it happens in a castle, but, you know, it's still basically unpacking this incredibly complicated web of relationships.
Such a pity Freud said that could be a great opening line for a novel, wouldn't it?
can't plagiarise Freud.
You were born in Northern Ireland, and a lot of people, and you live in Edinburgh, and a lot of people may not know that about you. This is only the second time, I think, that you've used Ireland as a setting for your work. So what prompted you to go back to it? Why there?
I think actually for a long time I was a bit wary writing about Ireland, actually. I thought in an odd way I didn't really have a right to do that. You know, I mean, Ireland, for such a small country, has produced and continues to produce, you know, an astonishing number of writers who are geniuses, you know. I don't know why, it became unavoidable in a sense. And I think Instructions for a Heatwave, the character of the mother, Greta, just one day she just started talking inside my head and wouldn't shut up, really. So I just thought, okay, here's somebody it has to be written about. So, and actually it's funny, when I was there, I was back in Dublin last month, and I handed in my green passport, and the guy said to me, "Welcome home." And I had this little kind of warm glow, and I thought, oh, that's nice.
This Must Be the Place by Maggie O'Farrell is published by Tinder Press. That's all we've time for this evening. Listen back on SoundCloud or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at BookshowRTE. Thanks to all our guests, and to producer Regan Hutchins and series producer Zoe Cummins.